envelopes, he shuffled pointedly as the five men arranged themselves at the table. The innocent-looking man laughed softly. "Well, gentlemen, I won't beat around the bush," he said. "That would be undignified, wouldn't it?" The Hierophant cleared his throat pointedly. "It is customary that introductions are made before any business is discussed, and then it will be the king who speaks first." The man grinned. "Is that so? I have so much to learn about decorum. By all means, let us introduct, then." He swept his arms out. "I am Mr. Capellatio, chief executioner of the Atlantis Carnival. My carnival, which, if you will recall, was once the carnival of the prophetess Lois, whose son I did wrest control of it from some years ago. This radiant star is my first wife, my scribe. As you can see, she is a breathtaking personage, a power beyond powers. These men are my adepts, my orbiters, my constituent brothers." The Hierophant held up a small bottle. "Before introductions, even, if you had given me a moment to speak, I must insist that we bless this meeting with an unction I have prepared." The four other men exchanged concerned glances. Finally turning to Mr. Capellatio, he continued to smile. "Ah, but we don't share your religion, priest. That is the very crux of our problem." He spread his hands. "We don't wish to offend, never that, but we won't be blessed by any unction concocted by the priest of a man whom we know to be a false king." Michael barely raised an eyebrow. "Am I a false king?" He looked to Marvel, John, Tygo, the guards, his expression one of pure enchantment. "I had no idea." Mr. Capellatio continued to grin, the corners of the mouth drawn up unflappably. He met each of their eyes in turn, including John's. "Yes, a false king. I am the true king, you see. I can't blame you for not knowing. There's probably no way you could have known." Michael's own smile did not falter. "I had thought I was king. I live here. I've lived here all my life. That's because my father was king, and his father before that, and so on. I had supposed that made me the king also." He began to laugh, then looked to John and Tygo, as if to say, "Is this truly happening? So you and your band of men have traveled all this way, in an illegal season, to tell me, quite politely, might I add, that I am not the king after all?" He pushed up his sleeves and revealed his blonde arms, where he wore a bracelet of metal forged from the launch site. He said, "If this is true, I believe I've heard enough." He paused, glancing at John specifically. "Though I would be interested to know what divination you used to reach this conclusion, I doubt I'll be encouraged to stay and listen." Marvel chuckled. "This man is obviously mad. It seems the zealots can still organize themselves from time to time." He raised a hand, and two of the guards advanced on the table with their pikes drawn. The woman shook her head. Her face was so pale that John wondered if she would be sick. Her hair, colorless and wispy as a girl's, was parted low on her forehead, so she appeared to have a very small face, upon which all her features were tight and refined. The hair was shining markedly for having no particular color. He decided he found her beautiful, although he did not know if she actually was. "He's not mad," she said in a slow voice. "He is the true king." The Hierophant continued to shake his head. The woman went on stiffly. "Astrologically speaking, there can be no fault to his claim. We have evidence. Years of scholarly study done by myself and my predecessors led us to this man, at this time. And now that we have arrived at the correct location, the last piece of the puzzle has fallen into place. There are records we could present you here if you want to read them." "Oh, but what evidence do you need beside the lights in the sky?" Mr. Capellatio pointed to the tall windows. I'm here. They're here. I'm sure you don't know, because how could you know, but we've entered a new age of mercy. I want so much to do this without violence. I've been violent all my life, and I can't regret it. But I'm tired of it. My men are tired of it. We've come to you with open arms to ask that you hear reason. The lights in the sky signify that this is the return. Right now. If the wrong king is on the throne, that is, if we have done wrong for all these centuries, we will pay for it when they arrive. Now is your chance to put things right. I am giving you that chance. He smiled again, emptily, because I'm the king. The Hierophant opened one of his folders. Do you suppose we will just give you the cape? The whole compound, the king's clothes and books, his precious metals. Marvel's face betrayed nothing. Should we give you the king's wife as well? He threw a long piece of paper onto the table, a map of the cape and its surrounding marshes, with areas darkened and crossed out. Our scouts have been all over your camp. We know where your men are, even the ones you believe we don't know about. We have twice as many men as you, but we will kill you right now, if that's the easiest way to put this nonsense down. You won't defeat us, Mr. Capellatio said. We will. We've done it before with others. I shouldn't have to remind you of the unrest. Marvel dusted his map off somewhat primly. Michael is a descendant of the astronauts. A direct descendant. If the return is now, he will greet them gladly and tell them himself. He met Mr. Capellatio's eyes. If this is the return. All this time, Tygo had been scrutinizing Mr. Capellatio, looking at him in the most peculiar way. I know what the lights are, he said softly. Everyone turned. John gaped at him. He seemed to John so foreign in that moment, a witless combination of assurance and naivete. A man willing to climb on a box to speak before a disparaging crowd, even after having done it before. What? Tygo stared at them. I do. I know what they are. Mr. Capellatio nodded. And who are you?
My servant, John said sadly. My assistant.
Michael was thrilled. He looked back and forth at John and Marvel.
Tell us then. Johnny, this man is a treasure. I have no idea who he is or why he's here, but he is an utter treasure.
Tygo patted his hair down over his ear holes.
The lights in the sky are angels. They're guiding the shuttles back to the Earth. I know because I was in Kansas, and in Kansas I had a vision, and that vision revealed this to me.
He stared again at all of them.
It sounds insane, I know, but the truth is stranger than anything anyone can make up. Ask Lord Astronomer. He's the one who freed me so I could help him ascertain the return date.
John remained silent for a long moment.
I don't know why I freed him. He is a madman.
The return date is now, said Mr. Capellatio. He looked annoyed.
Angels? That's some fairy tale. It's not got anything to do with our religion.
It does. That's what they called themselves when they spoke to me. Angels. And why not? They bring messages from above, and they speak their own language.
Here he trailed off helplessly, unable to explain. He blinked at John, nodding slightly.
I can't understand much of it. But some words come through, maybe by the very force of their will that I should understand. They told me the word Talokvovin, which I understood.
He turned about in his seat.
Which means falling death.
The Hierophant fingered the unction in the bottle. He kept his eyes on the bulb of the small glass stopper. For the first time, John wondered what he had intended to do with it. The liquid in the glass was very dark, almost black. But when the light hit it just so, it shone gold, but with weight, like mercury. Mr. Capellatio, impatient, watched Marvel's hands on the bottle as well.
I could be wrong, but my ears aren't hearing an overwhelming agreement to our righteous position, which is a shame. You have every opportunity to do the right thing. You haven't even reviewed our scholarship. I would have thought you would at least do that. Or have your man here. He gestured to Marvel. Do it. Where's your curiosity? In your minds, is there not a chance, even a slender chance, that Michael may just be a man, like any other, and that I might be the true king who will reign over the age of times? Michael's smile had faltered slightly. He turned to the Hierophant, who gripped the unction tightly. There is no chance, Marvel spoke calmly. I am the true king. It has been me for all time. But it was only recently, in cosmological time, that I became aware of it. He laughed again. His laughter was full of fearful anger. I act out my destiny. I can do nothing else in my life. His men were nodding. The two brothers and the blonde stout one were fidgeting. John supposed glumly that they'd concealed weapons somewhere on their persons, and that now he would probably die. They would be mad to come unarmed like they'd promised. For the first time, he wished he had a dagger of his own. Not that he would have known how to use it, but having one seemed suddenly so obvious. He was such a fool. The guards stood with their pikes behind them all, but they would protect Michael first, then the Hierophant. Tygo beside him had straightened. His voice was unafraid. The angels told me something else. Really, Susa, quiet your servant. He's making this worse, Marvel snapped. John looked away. The true king was part of my vision. The whole reason I came here to begin with, before they picked me up for treason and threw me into the jails. The angels told me the name of the king. They...
Before he could finish, one of the dark-haired brothers signaled to the other one, and with a floating motion, like the descent of a hummingbird, the one on the left reached into his cloak and threw a wet and heavy thing onto the table. The guards jolted forward, but stopped when they saw the object was only a sack, and that it lay on the table, inert. Mr. Capellatio's face was impassive.
In there, he said.
Michael eyed the Hierophant. Marvel turned to John. Horrified, he nudged it toward Tygo, who rubbed his hands together as though they were cold, but upended the bag on the table. How he felt when the contents of the bag were spilt. Drawn forward, pulled as if by a spell to look and look, eyes all over the bloodied and hacked disfigurement resting there, after rolling lazily for one half turn and spattering blood on the table, before them all. And then while his mind worked on what this object could be, revulsion exploded like a grease fire in his gut. He had seen his fair share of severed limbs. They all had since childhood. The parapets around the east wall of the palace were always strung with dead bodies, headless trophies atrophying and putrefying in the moldy Cape air. But out had tumbled a delicate and beautiful forearm and hand. Feminine. Almost childlike. Gray as a winter day, except for the blue tips of the fingers, and where the ovular bone had been cut through. This itself gave way to red along the ragged edges of the skin, and in the gory cross-section, the thin bone, white and possibly fragile, surrounded by as many colors of dark red as he could imagine existed under the sun. Mr. Capellatio was not smiling now. He looked very near tears.
How many fingers do you count there?
He asked them. Marvel, the Hierophant, had puffed up to his full roundness.
Get this abomination away from us! Guards!
The guards stepped forward, but Mr. Capellatio raised his voice.
How many fingers?
5,
said Tygo. Oh, you are the brightest star in the room, that is clear. What a servant! They are lucky to have you. I would make you my advisor, Angel Talker.
Yes, he said at length.
There are 5. This, gentlemen of the court, is my wife's hand. A powerful magic took it from her. The law of mercy.
He held up the woman's arm, and her sleeve fell down to reveal a bandaged stump.
Her eyes were closed. Orchid, my scribe, has given her writing hand for my cause. He closed his eyes, seemed to whisper a nonsense word, a prayer. He spoke it 5 times under his breath, then faced them once again. He was, it seemed, in an ecstasy. So, our 2 factions will clash here at the mouth of the sea. How fitting, for so like the sea is the sky, from which those metal luminaries will descend to take us into the ionosphere, the age of times, the days of heaven. Glorify! Michael gazed at the hand as though it were a dying baby. He is entirely mad, he whispered. The hand signifies the 5 carnivals we have outside the gate. 5 armies waiting for my indication that they should once more do what they have done for this last terrifying and holy eon of pain. To fight. To battle for their last field. It may be the age of mercy, but we cannot grant mercy to everyone. We cannot grant it to you if you will not receive it. He frowned. I have a great fear that you don't know what we're capable of. I'm sorry for it. But there's nothing to be done. You had a choice, and you chose wrong. Marvel picked up the hand and flung it across the great room. It smacked the far wall with an animate thud. This is beyond abhorrent. You, my unfortunate zealots, must die now, every one of you. And your people at the gates will be executed upon our black stage for months and years to come. We will kill every one of them we catch. Their blood will run into the earth and cleanse it of your sin. He reached for the unction, but before he could grasp it, Tygo leaned over the table and clasped Mr. Capellatio's hands between his own, like a lover. John had already pushed his chair slightly away from the table in case things became violent, but he stopped now, fascinated with horror. Tygo said, The angels told me the name of the true king. I heard it in Kansas, and followed that word all the way across the land, to this moment. Is your name David? Mr. Capellatio seemed confused. His attention had flown with the hand as it sailed across the room. He seemed to want to fetch it, to go comfort it. What? He asked in a soft voice. Mr. Capellatio's eyes went from each of their faces to the next, and finally at last to Tygo's, to whom he nodded with grim pride. My name is David, though how you could know it must be a deep magic indeed. Who are you? No magic, whispered Tygo. I saw it. I heard it. One of Mr. Capellatio's men had drawn a dagger, and John saw it in an instant. He leapt up and back from the table, just as the man with the dagger, the blonde, stocky one, pulled Mr. Capellatio back and behind him, brandishing the weapon in front. The other 3 men surrounded him as they began backing from the room. The woman did not move. The guards surged forward with pikes pointed viciously, but they'd waited too long. Afterward, John would think often about this mystery. Why had they waited? Perhaps they were afraid of the 4 men conjuring more magical weapons from the folds of their robes. Or perhaps they'd hesitated because of some feral strength in Mr. Capellatio's voice when he said simply, Be still. For John had become still then, too, without realizing it, freezing in place just steps from the table. Then Marvel Parsons cast his glass bottle and whatever enigmatic liquid it contained at the group of outlaws— And the bottle shattered and exploded upward some concoction of gases and fumes that began immediately to choke them. They fell to their knees. The cloud enveloped them, and John could see nothing of them for long seconds. He only heard their choking and gagging as he backed away into a far corner of the great hall, distancing himself as much as possible from whatever had been inside the bottle. The Hierophant and Michael immediately slipped out through a small service doorway, located just behind the great table. The clouds spread to the main entrance, where even the 2 guards posted by the door succumbed to it. John realized Tygo had followed him. He was there too, pressed into the corner, listening to the death of the men inside the miasma. There was nothing to do but wait. He looked down at the smaller man, pained. Do you really speak to angels?
Only that one time, with my shaving mirror.
What about Talokvovin?
Daigo had a manner of looking entirely calm, even disinterested, when he said surprising things.
I made that up so you would believe me.
John only nodded.
Oh, of course.
Is this the return?
Daigo raised his eyebrows.
No, but we'll all die if we stay here. That's the truth. Those lights are meteors, bound for the Cape. Nothing here will survive when they hit.
There will not be three more appearing soon, to make five, to carry us heavenward.
No.
A muted thud. It was his heart sinking. He hadn't realized how he had hoped.
Oh.
Almost offhandedly, Taigo said after a time,
That man, Mr. Capellatio, is the true king, though. We should save him.
What?
I saw it in my vision. He is David. He's needed in Kansas. That's where I came from.
Now Taigo was shrugging.
I told you some of the truth.
John wrinkled his brow, putting his fingertips to his temples.
Why didn't you just tell me all of this?
You wouldn't have believed me.
Taigo's face unmoving, until his mouth twitched downward into a small smile.
Then they saw the one-handed woman. She was walking toward them around the cloud, just skirting the edge of it, completely fearless. Her expression made no sense. She was smiling.
You believe in him, she said to them.
But before Taigo could move, the four guards advanced on the thinning cloud and began stabbing the four men until they were covered in blood and motionless, just piles of blood-stained clothing, limbs splayed this way and that. John hoped they were dead before the blows, but he suspected they were probably not. John's eyes fell on the pile of men, and he saw, at the same time Taigo saw, that David, Mr. Capellatio, the true king, was nowhere. The guards turned their pikes toward the woman, but she raised her arms again, so her sleeves again fell and revealed her stump.
I am helpless, she said. Just a mutilated captive.
They looked to John.
Don't just stand there. Seize her, he said, although he did not know why.
The woman looked dangerous, but not like she would do them immediate harm. One took hold of her. She held John's eyes with her own horrible ones. They were like holes gored out by an animal.
A long time ago, I had an accident, she said. It cost me my ability to bear children. Before my accident, I could see things. Not the future. No one can see the future. But I could see other things. People's hearts. What drove them. But seeing made me unhappy.
Her cheeks had flushed with the exertion of speaking.
You had a vision, she said to Taigo. Of my husband?
I suppose.
Tell me.
There's a man in Kansas, a kind of high priest, the Mystagogue. I was taken up on charges of surgery. To work off my debt, they made me his servant. That was when I had my vision. He believed me.
Tygo's face seemed to dissolve and reform.
The Mystagogue knew my vision to be genuine, so he sent me here, to get David.
He pointed to the dissipating cloud,
to bring him back.
You believe,
she said again, to both of them this time,
without a text to guide you.
In the weird light choked by the fumes of the phlegmatic gases, John wanted to answer yes, but it was not that he believed in that man, her husband. He believed in Taigo. He believed in Tygo's vision. John pulled at his ill-fitting jeweled collar, finally yanking it off. Without thinking, he dropped it onto the floor. Taigo replied, surprise in his voice.
Yes, I guess I do. I didn't until I did. And then I had no choice.
What about you?
The woman asked John, but Taigo answered for him.
John requires proof.
She nodded like the answer satisfied her. John muttered,
Shouldn't you two save your king? He must be unconscious by now. Or dead.
What should I do with the woman? Asked the guard.
Let her go. What can she do? She's a cripple.
When she was free, the woman remarked, it is the way of faith that it often feels like despair. John and Tygo walked out of the tower and into the courtyard, across a plank bridge that led over the ornamental stream that trickled through the compound. The evening stillness breathtaking. No siege had yet begun, just a few courtiers strolling the closing market stalls. No murmurs leaking from beyond the walls. None they could hear, anyway. It was unclear, in that moment, what would happen. The strange woman had simply walked away from them. They stood in the hushed glare of the sunset. At the very end of the day, the sun had broken through again. John watched the sky, feeling the weight of his accumulated failures begin to dissolve. All his life he had suffered to make his work matter, and of course, he had been wrong the entire time. Altogether wrong. About all of it. But then he thought of the horoscope he'd drawn up a few hours ago, the ascending planet. There was hope there. For his methods, the methods might yet be sound. Perhaps if he directed himself more properly, if he gave up this place, the Cape, its overindulgences. For 20 years he had been laboring under a set of false parameters. His work, yes, all flawed, but perhaps recoverable. It would be difficult. It may take another 20 years. He looked at the Stella Novi, brighter now in the fading light. Still numbering 2. "When is the return?" he asked no one, but Tygo answered. "I don't know. No one does." John nodded. He motioned to the Stella Novi. "To Lochvovin. You may have made it up, but it's true anyway." "There's not much time," Tygo said gravely. "I see him, I think," John said, his voice light. "David, over there. He's behind that cistern." "Ah, we should get him then." John felt calm, even as he stared up into the sky at his own certain death. What was there to do but move forward? When Mr. Capellatio saw them, he didn't run. He coughed, wiped his hands on his pants, and nodded to them both with a restrained elegance. His adepts, it seemed, had managed to cover him while he ran from the room. John was unamazed. They had seemed wily enough, the group of them. After all, they'd gotten this far. Mr. Capellatio's slick black hair had fallen from its arrangement. He looked despondent. When greeted with the news that his 4 henchmen had been brutally struck down, he did curse the Cape and all who dwelled within, as though he had cared for his men in some regard. "What of my wife?" "She escaped." He smiled. "Of course she did. She is a miracle." He then gripped Tygo's shoulder tightly and thanked him. Tygo said nothing. Very quickly they were able to arrange Tygo's dress cloak over Mr. Capellatio so that he was mostly hidden. So they went out of the compound in broad daylight. They took John's carriage, Mizar driving them to the outskirts of the outlaw carnival, the village of booths and tents and streamers and heads. Mr. Capellatio rode the entire way with a look on his face that could have extinguished the sun. John watched it all with the bland tolerance of one who trusted. This irony struck him only faintly. It was as though he had been wound up all his life, a toy, an automaton. And at last he was slowing down. His true nature had lain just beneath his anxiety all along. It was quietude. It was acceptance. He sat in the carriage, silent, suddenly grateful for every single thing, even for the years of struggle he had endured. As they entered the outlaw carnival, he looked at the unfamiliar world around him, the colorful tents, the basins of blood. His leg itched. He was, for a moment, happy, in spite of all of it. "My wives," Mr. Capellatio was saying. "I must find my wives, before they find each other." Chapter 23 Escape. Marvel Whiteside Parsons watched Michael pace and complain that he was not born a monk. This was irritating to Marvel. They had escaped down the service corridor and emerged into another grand empty room where the floor was a magnificent mirrored tile. From here they could hear nothing except their own footsteps as they echoed around the space. No fighting. No ringing of metal. This room, a somewhat smaller banqueting hall, was never used. Or it had not been since Leander was king. Marvel went to one of the tall windows and pulled up the hammered metal shade. The golf course. Peaceful evening light, slanting over the ground like a stencil. A golden dog running across the seventh hole, and a man on the grass now with a rolling blade, cutting it shorter. Michael could not be still, his steps ricocheting on the cool floor. He was speaking, but Marvel was hardly paying attention. The most important thing in the world seemed to be these few creatures just outside the window, going about their business, unaware of the encroaching danger. He thought of where his daughter might be at this hour. He didn't know what she did in the afternoons. Probably she smoked and gossiped with her handmaids. Or she might be walking one of her dogs. He knew he would never see her again.
The law does sanction war when heresies are manifested bodily. That is this. Clearly. I never saw such a clear case. There is no question, Michael was saying. I remember my law classes. Somewhat. I'm definitely sure we're justified to send our soldiers against these madmen.
Of course we are.
Have you really scouted their camp?
Certainly.
And do we have twice as many men?
Marvel pulled his gaze from the window. Michael stood in the center of the room, like a motherless fawn in a clearing. Of course we don't.
How many do we have?
He was nodding as though he'd known this all along. Many less. Half as many.
Don't think about it. We have the advantage of superior weaponry and, of course, our wall.
Yes, Michael continued to nod.
The wall. It was magicked recently.
Better. It's been reinforced many times from the inside. The outer layer of glass is less majestic than it once was, but from the inside. Marvel tried to smile encouragingly. He was trying to figure out how he could escape. Alone. He had to leave now, or he would get caught up in the fighting.
It's impenetrable. Michael went back to pacing. What did you think of their nonsense about me not being king? It's heresy. You said so yourself.
Marvel turned back, impatient. Michael had thrown off his bejeweled robe and stood anxiously in his undershirt and the plain pants he'd kept on beneath the robe. He twisted his bracelet on his arm, up past his wrist, apparently seeing how far he could push it up before it cut off his circulation.
Heresy. Yes, and yet... Sousa's horoscope.
His voice ran off somewhat dejectedly.
It does make me more uneasy now, after this confrontation. What do you think?
Sousa is an abject failure. All these years he has had one job.
One job, Michael. And that was to predict the return. He's never done it. Why you put any stock in his astrology is baffling to me. And always has been.
Michael sputtered a laugh.
It's only... John's horoscope did show an ascendant planet. And not my own planet. What am I to make of that, when confronted by this new man who claims to be king?
Then, because he couldn't restrain himself,
it could be that this other man is the king, Marvel. Anything could be.
Marvel Whiteside Parsons knew that Michael was not the true king. Apparently, Sousa knew it too. Tygo knew it, and even that outlaw pretender knew it. Marvel felt a sudden anger form a molten ball in his stomach. If only he had left earlier. His dithering, his endless coming and going, such weakness he had shown. Now was the worst time to leave. Michael would be lost without him. And yet, if Marvel himself wanted to live, if he wanted to spend his last days in Kansas serving the religion of Hulda, his ancestor, he must go. He shook Michael slightly, only slightly, and looked into his greenish eyes.
John's horoscope is nothing. You are the king. But how will I know if I am?
Marvel tried not to show his frustration, but couldn't help it.
Knowing, he choked. How does one know anything?
You are, Michael, king. Because you are here, right now, and your people within these walls look to you, and on top of that, a large majority of this great land honors your authority. That gives you kingship.
But even as he spoke, he could see Michael's doubt giving way to crisis. And Marvel Whiteside Parsons knew that feeling well. He had left his own kingdom, his own chance to be king, in search of this thing that so moved Michael now. Where was the truth? And how does one find it? The Pardoness had said truth finds everyone eventually. He peered at Michael. His outburst had been unkind, and yet Michael did not look upset.
I know I am a good king, Michael muttered. The true king. What is that? Some sort of Kansas nonsense?
Yes, said Marvel. Just something someone made up. It's meaningless. At the window again, Marvel could not help but watch each oblivious person tottering about their work, going from tower to tower, through the small streets and around corners, each one following a course he set for himself, as well as one set for him by others. He heard Michael breathing at his back, more calmly now. In due time, Michael was standing at his side, coherent. Marvel had called for writing implements, and they drafted a summons requiring all men within the compound to present themselves at once for war. Boys, too, older than 14, though no one would ask their ages before sending them into battle. Marvel could not quite guess how the battle would unfold, though he was unsurprised to learn from a messenger that Mr. Capellatio had escaped the melee. How remained a mystery, but the guards were certain he was still in the compound. No one had seen him leave. How could he escape, after all? There was no escape. Marvel kept his doubts to himself. As the summons was being read from every balcony, in every lane and every path within the compound, Marvel and Michael still stood in the abandoned great room, alone again. It had been very speedy, all of it. The others had come and gone, a parade of guards in masks trotting before them, ready to be ordered here and there. The master of the stables. The master of the cannons. There was some talk of preparing oil to disperse through the outlaw camp, which could then be set on fire if it came to that. Michael had thought of that, but he wanted to use it as a last resort. There was a goodness in the man that no amount of pragmatism could put down. Marvel did admire that, in a way. It made things difficult, but he could not deny the grace of it. He once again turned his gaze outside, through the window glass, which was very old and had sunk somewhat, pooling at the bottoms of the panes in graduated ripples. His attention was drawn by a general clamor and uproar as word of the summons spread. But Marvel felt compelled to look also because he was looking for something. He knew the grounds so well. They had changed little since Leander was king, except for the golf course. A silly notion compelled him to keep looking down again, and then he saw, with his own eyes, John Sousa, the chief orbital doctor, mounting his carriage in the courtyard. Climbing in behind John was Tygo, and another figure, this one taller and draped in a ceremonial robe. John's manservant was already in the front seat of the wagon. It was the leader of the outlaws, David. A wire seemed to pull taut within Marvel, a blaze of recognition. Tygo had been sent to find that man. Well, he had found him, and now he was rescuing him. Whoever David was, he was wanted badly enough by the Mystagogue that he had sent two men over the deathscapes to fetch him. Marvel did not know if that portended good or evil, but his heart leapt in his chest as he gripped the window ledge. Nudging Michael, he motioned to John's wagon, which was just now pulling around out of sight, toward the door they used for larger cargo. Michael shrugged.
He's not expected to fight. He's imperative to the crown.
But Marvel pointed at the extra figure in the open carriage, and Michael rounded on him with wide brown eyes.
The outlaw is escaping with them.
It would appear that way.
But why in heaven's name are they helping him?
As though the idea of such insubordination exasperated his capacity for understanding. Marvel walked quickly over the tiled floor, ordering guards in pursuit. But he knew it was too late. He left the room, determined to keep walking until he had walked away from the cape forever. This was the moment of his decision. He must seize it. It was like walking away from a pan of boiling water. Eventually it would dry up, bubble and warp. There would be damage. It would not get better before it got worse. But then, it would be over. Chapter 24. The Law of Mercy. The wives Mr. Capellaccio sought were not easy to find in the commotion of the outlaw carnival. John identified at once that it was several different groups, with correspondingly different tents and different booths and different-looking people, milling together now as though assembled for a bazaar or a trading fair. But their faces were odious to behold. Each man, each woman, and there were some women, he was surprised by that. He'd always heard they were not allowed on the carnival circuit. Strode about fixed by some purpose of violence. And the wind was drawing up now as the first fires of evening were lit. The torches that lined the long rows and seemed to form the basic organization of the paths. Heads on pikes. Everywhere. At every turn, John felt he might walk straight into one. He stepped gingerly, his arms held out before him, like he was afraid of walking through a cobweb. How awful that would be, to touch noses with one of those things, his own face pressed up to one of those sunken green snouts. They had left Mizar with the wagon, in a circle with other wagons. The livery of the Sousa family stood in contrast to the black carnival wagons, painted with skulls and rocket ships and other magical things. Mizar looked helpless as he stood there beside it, still in his servant's jacket. John told him to stay put and stay hidden. "You're an old man now. Do what old men do, and take a nap," he'd said, cruelly perhaps. It was difficult for him to ever know how he sounded to Mizar, who only nodded congenially, as he always did, and at everything, every sight he had ever seen, and every command he had ever been given. Then Mizar had crawled up into the wagon and tossed back a swig of water from a canteen hung on his belt. John envied that, the water. Mizar eternally prepared. Then John and Tygo were walking with David all over the wretched, dirty camp. Past frying whole goats, women in black masks, past buckets and basins and vats of soapy-looking blood. His head swam. John found it was a buzz with motion, small movements and large ones, torch shadows flickering, men stacking things, men draining things, people pouring from this place to that one in anticipation of some grand signal. Or so it seemed. But how? He'd asked Mr. Capellaccio, David, trotting along behind him as they looked for his two wives. He did for an instant wonder if that was a code word. Wives. So lost was he here, and Tygo beside him, taking it all in with a face like a docile sheep, but as tense beside John, as if he were about to have a tooth extracted. "But how?" John had asked again. "How is it that they are so well prepared?" He imagined the scramble inside the palace compound, and he was glad to be out here, though he did wish someone would give him a weapon. A knife. Anything. David had laughed at John's question. "These are carnival men. They've been waiting for war since we got here. They barely need to put on their shoes." Finally they stopped walking, when David was approached by a crone. She was horrifically old, with a hair form that sagged. Perhaps she'd been caught in the rain. She was fat, her face painted as crones often do before executions, with two long ochre smears beneath the eyes and above them. John drew back slightly. The woman whispered to David for a long time, and his expression fell with every passing second, though he was nodding in agreement with whatever unhappy news she bore. Nothing on her face registered emotion. "Ah," said David. "What I feared." "What is it?" asked Tygo. His face was wet with sweat. John had not realized how hot it was in the carnival, with all the fires raging around them. The crone had caught them just as they passed a thicket of heads on pikes, perhaps 50 of them, propped up almost like a memorial. To what? John couldn't even imagine. The head closest to him appeared to be a child. But no, he looked closer. It was a man, just shrunken with age and rot. The eyes sewn closed with red string. David sent the crone away. "She brings me news of my first wife." Then he glared. "Appalling news."
"Well," said Tygo,
"you're not my advisor.
What does it matter to you?"
"You can't waste your men on storming the castle. It will do you no good, and it will cost hundreds of lives. Let's go away, now, back to Kansas. It's unsafe here. The lights in the sky."
"Yes," said David.
"The return."
"No," Tygo hurried.
"That word I said, to Lochvovin. It means falling death."
David vacantly nodded, and John shook his head.
"The lights are meteors! We'll all die if we stay here!" Tygo shouted.
"The lights are the shuttles." David glanced toward the grove of heads on pikes. For a moment, he seemed to be considering dashing among them, hiding there perhaps.
"I haven't got time for this. The crone has delivered very disappointing news. Orchid has taken my second wife, my sigil."
He paused, wrapped his hand around one of the pikes.
"This is very worrying to me, actually. She is, in my estimation, the finest executioner ever to live in this world. She has a way with the blade.
Oh, I see your faces, gentlemen.
Damn her injury. It's not about strength. It is about...
well, it is about magic."
He cradled his own head in his hand. "My orchid. My prism of accurate divination. She was the daughter of our prophetess Lois, who did bed me as a youth, and who in her great age conceived a child by me, just like Hulda."
His eyelashes sent lacy shadows over his cheeks in the firelight. "You know, a part of me always believed Hulda's child was conceived with her own son, Lee." He laughed, surprised at himself.
"I never said that to anyone before, but it's really the only explanation."
"Oh, and Hulda's age. Well, what does old really mean? She could have been 40. Or 30.
We will never know her age, for sure."
He blinked. "The prophetess Lois was not really 79 when she died. It was just what we told everyone." John eyed Tygo.
"What is he talking about?"
he whispered. The streamers on the pikes whipped around in a sudden gust of breeze. Yellows and reds, maroons, illuminated by the fires spluttering. The dark was complete now. It was fully night. Tygo shook his head.
"Come with us, David."
David pulled up one of the pikes, then drove it down again in another place. He seemed not to like this placement either, and repeated the gesture, hissing an incantation beneath his breath, some string of words that John couldn't catch. Then he spoke louder.
"Orchid still believes she is meant to be queen of the Cape."
"No one is meant to rule here. Damn you, listen to me," Tygo said.
"We should leave. We must."
A plaintive note entered his voice. John had heard it only once before, when Tygo was begging for his life, making his prediction about the lady's bleeding.
"We'll take the Cape. It's what we came here to do," David said. "The Mystagogue needs you alive."
"I'm a lucky son of a bitch. I was born for this." He straightened his shoulders. "I won't die.
It's not possible."
Tygo opened his mouth again, but suddenly the ground shook with a force that knocked the three of them to their knees. Many of the piked heads fell over, and one landed next to John. He batted it away, even though up close the head was somewhat less upsetting than he had imagined. Just the hardened leather of skin, the smell of sand and sun and a wisp of rot thrown in, no more redolent than a mildewed bedsheet. There were only X's for eyes to look back at him.
"Are they trying to blow up the wall?" John choked, clamoring to his feet. "It's 10 feet thick. It stood for 1,000 years.
David pushed a stack of pikes and heads off his back.
"They will get through."
He reached into his pocket and pulled out a small thing, a black amber brooch, just a plain piece of polished stone with a pin stuck to the back. It caught the torchlight. John knew these things. They were for executions.
though the ones people wore at the Cape were much more finely crafted, often made in the shape of a family's patron animal. He owned himself one that looked like a guinea hen, passed down from his mother. He'd never worn it. David pinned it to his shirt front.
"Ah," he said. "They will be needing me at the front for inspiration."
He strode away from them then, his hand wandering to his belt in search of a knife. Finding none, he picked one up off the ground, checked it over, wiped the blade between the folds of his shirt, and kept walking. At once terrified of their surroundings, John and Tygo scurried after him. In this place, everything blinked in and out of shadow, and every eye seemed alight with madness. David was hard to catch. He so quickly blended into the crowd. A mile away in the distance and to John's right, he could just see the metallic castle within the compound walls. The high outer wall, encrusted with broken glass, reflected the torches of the approaching carnival men. Shanties and booths and huts and people appeared in increasing numbers, clotting as they went closer to the wall. He passed sheep and goats, spindle-legged and black with curved, vicious horns and demonic eyes and hooves that could kill a man with one kick. Farther down the path, they met men on horses, magicians with their girdles of chalky, severed heads and intoxicated eyes, carts with wood for fires, a man with a musket, a barking dog. The fighting had begun. David was lost in the crowd. The battle raged on unchecked around them, people circulating like blood, standing, falling, crying out at the moment of their own deaths. For the longest time, John just watched, until a huge man came at him with a club studded with spikes. He was confused momentarily, because it was a palace guard, and John was obviously, himself, a court official, an important courtier. Why ever would this guard run at him with such a look of bloodlust in his eyes? But that was exactly why. It was a lust, John thought, the idea coming to him wildly as he dodged the blow. Some instinct kicked in, a kind of levity raised him out of his body. He saw himself narrowly avoid the clubbing. He saw himself turn and take up a pike from a man who had fallen dead beside him. Then he saw himself thrust it deep between the guard's shoulders. The passion ran past the moment of doing it, and after the man had fallen, John stood there, panting. Tygo shrugged a little, as if to say, "It was that or die yourself." And then John pulled the pike from the still-breathing man. He did not look back, because he did not want to see a thing he could never unsee. After that, he found himself a part of the battle, not as a believer fighting for the truth, because in the moment of the fight, all ideology, old and new, vanished. He fought as a person who wanted simply to keep on being alive. He received a bash to the head, a slash across the back of his thigh. All that mattered was that he would live. It was within his power to keep himself living. He vacillated between hiding behind wagons and ungracefully striking out when he gathered the courage. Beside him, Tygo kept slashing forward. The momentum of activity was enough. He had learned to fight somewhere, at least much better than John ever had. He watched the other man drop his pike for a knife as the opportunity presented itself, and then the knife for a sword. So John did the same, fumbling with the heavier and heavier weapons. Every so often he caught a glimpse of David far up ahead, smiling as he cut people down. Once he stood tall and met John's eyes, a head dangling by its hair from his fist. He looked different on this battlefield, and certainly different from how John had imagined a true king might look. And yet, David seemed to have been born for this exactly. John stopped to rest. Many hours into the battle, there were fewer people. The outlaws had breached the compound wall. They streamed inside. The fighting continued there. The screams grew farther away. John sat down in a pile of canvas. It had once been a tent. Tygo had gone for water. Then he saw her through a maze of toppled stones. She wore a plumed helmet now, with the short ends of her hair sticking out. She'd cut her dress off at the knee so she could run. Overhead, those two amazing lights shone their alarm down on them all, like an awful being waiting for them to die. Behind them, their arcs of light. John felt he was looking into a dream. She did not seem afraid of any living being. Handless, covered in blood. Yes, smiling. Just like David. She was smiling at him now. She saw him. John's heart leapt into his throat. A young girl in white stood behind her, her wrists chained together, fastened to a metal collar around her neck. Orchid nodded to him. She had noticed him walking toward her before he'd noticed her. When he reached her, he could not speak. He'd gone to her like she'd summoned him. She touched his shirt. Behind them, something caught fire. A sound like wings beating as it went up in flames. Neither of them looked. The heat coming off it made John's left side redden. She didn't seem to notice. "The man who needs proof," she hissed. "You must have found something undeniable to have left your friendly palace for this filth pit." The girl lurched from behind her, screaming, "Help me! She's going to kill me!" "For my bastard of a husband, you came here." She looked beyond him over the field of dead and dying people. All her features were crowded on her face, the upturned snub of her nose bathed in the light of the fires. "Oh, but so did I suppose. What a fool I've been. This will not end well for any of us. I have a feeling." "The end," John gasped at last. "It's coming." "Oh, I know it will. No, the end of the world, of this world, the cape." He felt that he was a carving of a man about to fall from a great height. What would remain when he smashed open? "The lights in the sky, they're meteors." Now she did not speak. Her bandaged stub was dark with watery blood. The girl's chain was fastened to a thick girdle around Orchid's stomach.
"She's going to kill me," sobbed the young girl. "Please save me."
"Don't kill her," John implored.
"Leave. We must all leave. I'm the rightful queen of the cape. This is my kingdom."
Then John pulled her close to him, their chests touching. They were each covered in blood and sweat. She let him hold her, even sinking into him. The fire flickered over her helmet.
"I cannot kill this stupid girl," Orchid whispered in his ear. "Wonderblood is over. There is a law of mercy now. I cannot dehead her as I once would have."
He did not know what she meant. She pushed back from him, her face turned up toward him like a heliotrope.
"Will you kill her for me?"
The girl met his eyes across the dark.
"Her men chained me. She has a key around her neck. Save me."
I can't execute anyone."
Orchid pushed him away.
"Then what good are you to me?" "Leave," I said.
He grasped her hand with both of his.
"You have to. Not without the sigil. David cannot do a thing without her."
John looked to the girl, then back to Orchid.
"Take her with you, then."
"No!"
the girl screamed again.
"Don't let her take me!"
"Where would I go?" Orchid spat. "Back on the circuit? There are my people, helping him."
She motioned with her stump toward the fighting, which was now raging inside the compound walls.
"All I've made of my life is his now."
She pulled on the girl's chain again, and the girl cried out as her head was jerked down with her arms.
"Where is my sword?
I cannot even use it. She has cut off my good hand."
There were no tears in the woman's eyes. John did not know why he was talking to her, what compulsion drove him, except that now, having been shown the truth, he wanted, needed, to tell someone.
"Go to Kansas," he whispered. "We are. It's where we should have been this whole time, where the true king will rule. We've been wrong this whole time."
"But the texts.
Everyone was wrong."
"How do you know?"
He gazed at her helplessly.
"I just do.
David will never leave this place. He has dreamt of the cape since killing our prophetess Lois. He was born for this moment."
The woman was backing away from him now.
She was singularly the most magnetic person he had ever seen.
Even handless, she throbbed with a power that could not be contained. She pulled off her helmet with her one hand. The feather plume fluttered to the ground, where it soaked through and disappeared in a puddle of mud. The girl sobbed.